Well, good day and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and it's great to have everybody here. We've got a great episode coming up for you and a clinical topic, which is something some people have been asking for. We know based upon downloads and things like that, that we get a little bump when we do some more clinically focused topics. So this is something of interest for some of you out there that I think you'll like. Before we get into the topic, though, let's go ahead and introduce our co-host and clinical giant in her own respect, Sam Bradley.
Well, that's one thing you've never called me, Jamie, a clinical giant. I appreciate that. But I don't hold a candle to Dr. Joe. I mean, he knows everything Dr. Joe does.
And no, not hardly.
We're going to pick his brain just a little bit tonight. Hi, Joe.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good, good. Now, this topic, you know, the topic we're covering tonight kind of came up for me. I started thinking about, for my other shows like the Medic Cast and the Nursing Show, I start thinking about clinical topics to cover as we get into different seasons. So as winter season rolls around, I start thinking about things like hypothermia. And then I started thinking about disaster topics, and carbon monoxide poisoning came up. And one of the reasons I think this is important for us to think about here in a disaster podcast setting is, and I'll just kind of lay the kind of idea that occurred to me, in presence of disasters, and around here in wintertime, we get ice storms, we lose power for a period of time, everybody pulls out their generator and fires it up so they can keep their freezers going and their well pumps running and things like that while the power's out. And it's a challenge because when that happens, we almost always have at least one carbon monoxide poisoning call related to people inappropriately using their generators too close to the house, or even, God forbid, in the house because they want to keep warm. And this is a big problem. And I started to wonder what would happen in a major disaster incident when a USAR team like you guys, Joe, come into a community in cold weather where the power's been out, or even in good weather when the power's out and people come in and their generators are running, and you encounter a whole house full of people who are lethargic, unconscious, and you start wondering, is this a CO poisoning situation? So I thought this might be a topic we could cover, talk about the clinical presentation, talk about the treatments, and how disaster responders or first responders in any community might respond to people in this situation.
Well, I think it's a great topic, Jamie. You know, I think one of the biggest challenges with it is, you know, first of all, sort of thinking of it, but the other challenge is sort of sorting out in a disaster setting the tremendously varied differential diagnosis for something like that. You know, you have a patient who's acting confused and lethargic and may have some nausea, vomiting, may have some neurological findings of some sort, and, you know, may have been several days to a disaster. And, you know, you have to literally worry about everything from hypoglycemia to CO poisoning to head injury to hypothermia to electrolyte disturbances that are really severe if they've been, you know, in a situation where they've been deprived of adequate water and that sort of stuff, to, you know, toxins or inhalation injuries of some other sort, especially if they're in a situation where they're trapped or at least confined in a fairly small space. So carbon monoxide is definitely one of those things that we would think about. We do have some tools like the RAD 57 and some of those sort of things that allow you to get a carbon monoxide level in a very rapid fashion in the field. Unfortunately, those are pretty expensive. They're not terribly available in the disaster situation. And oftentimes you sort of end up having to rule out as many things as you can and sort of use your clinical acumen and push forward with treatment and further observation on those patients.
Joe, would you agree that oxygen is the best treatment for that?
Oh, no question about it. Yeah, it really is all about getting that carbon monoxide off the hemoglobin molecule and getting oxygen back on there. And I think, as most folks will remember, carbon monoxide bonds very aggressively to hemoglobin, much more so than oxygen does. And, of course, part of the problem is oxygen doesn't want to let go of carbon monoxide. And so it you can't deliver O2 to the tissues, but you also can't utilize that hemoglobin molecule for anything else until you get that carbon monoxide molecule off of there. So O2 helps to speed that process along pretty aggressively. You know, if you look at carbon monoxide exposures that are quite mild with no treatment except, you know, getting away from the source of carbon monoxide, it usually takes about 24 hours to get your carbon monoxide level back to the baseline. If you use 100% oxygen, then that may be, as you know, 4 to 6 hours before you get back to a normal baseline. And then if you use things like hyperbaric oxygen or oxygen under high pressure, where you can put the patient in a sealed environment and deliver oxygen at 2 or 3 atmospheres, then you can reduce that carbon monoxide level quite quickly that way.
Yeah, I found some interesting statistics on the CDC site. They said more than 400 Americans die from unintentional CO poisoning not linked to fires, probably what Jamie was talking about, from incomplete combustion. More than 20,000 visit the emergency room, and more than 4,000 are hospitalized every year. So that's really a lot of people. And I think sometimes, you know, I know in the pre-hospital world, right when it starts getting cold and people start firing up their heaters for the first time, that's when we tend to see a lot of this, because then they start shutting the windows so there isn't any good ventilation. And sometimes, you know, you get that incomplete combustion that's backing up into the house. And it doesn't always occur to the provider when they walk in and see 5 people down. You know, what do we learn in hazmat? You see more than one person down, you've got a hazardous material issue of some kind. And there's also the secondary issue of, are the exposure of the responders going to be exposed to it if they walk in there? And, you know, what about that, Jamie?
Well, I am also checking out the CDC site. And for those of you out there, if you aren't utilizing resources like going to cdc.gov and just searching for a clinical topic, you're really missing the boat, because I actually found a clinical guidance for carbon monoxide poisoning after a disaster. And it talks about things like generators, propane grills, camp stoves, even people burning gasoline to stay warm in a home. These are all things that can cause CO poisoning and the concurrent symptoms. And it's something that we need to be aware of, because we can put ourselves at risk. We walk into an environment that's problematic. And of course, you know, people die from this. People become hospitalized from this, and people, 20,000 people are visiting the emergency room at any given time. So it's a real problem. And I think that it's something we need to be aware of. So, you know, one of the things is, we can check the air in the home if we have the proper tool, like Joe said, and we can ascertain if there is the presence of carbon monoxide above normal levels. But really, for the patient, it requires a blood test. It requires getting a carboxyhemoglobin level, which requires labs to do that, which requires a hospital in most situations. So, you know, this is not something in a disaster we're likely to have access to. And so, Joe, do you just use your standard differential diagnostic tools and think in that direction if you can't find any other cause, or do you have to really be more prepared and have more resources available?
Well, I think the first caveat here is a high index of suspicion, and you're exactly right, especially in disaster situations where you have people who are improvising and improvising in, you know, pretty extreme ways in some cases, and especially those who have a poor knowledge of the concerns around carbon monoxide poisoning in the first place. You know, the idea is, well, it's cold out and I've got a barbecue grill and, you know, that thing makes a lot of heat and I can cook some food on it. I might as well move the thing into the garage and, you know, collect the heat as well. Yet they're also collecting carbon monoxide off of that. So I think a high index of suspicion is extremely important, in all situations, especially in the winter time, but, much more so in a disaster situation where, folks are a bit more desperate. The number of people who are improvising are, quite a bit greater than they would be, routinely. But I think the nice thing is with carbon monoxide poisoning, the treatment is in of itself pretty innocuous. It's high flow oxygen, and you're unlikely to cause any significant problem to the vast majority of patients unless they have some real significant underlying pulmonary lung issues, et cetera, with high flow O2 on someone like that. I think part of what's important to remember is that chronic CO poisoning can certainly be present in someone who's been living in a house that may have freestanding gas heaters and the maintenance hasn't been great. The structure is older and the product is not working like it should be, and they're not very diligent about having a carbon monoxide detector or something else in the home. So, lots of issues there during the wintertime. And the concern from the carbon monoxide issue is not only is an acute poisoning or intoxication with carbon monoxide dangerous, but so is chronic CO poisoning. And, in many cases, folks can be neurologically impaired for a very long time. After a significant exposure to carbon monoxide, whether it's acute or chronic or acute on chronic. Much like sort of lead paint exposure, it's an issue that needs to be looked for and treated aggressively and dealt with not only from the short-term issues, but from the long-term consequences as well.
Do you ever, when you guys get deployed in the USAR environment, and where you're coming in and you're starting to look in a community and start going home to home, one of the things that leaps out to me is that we do in our area is there's a lot of education that comes out, especially on social media channels, about appropriate use of heating devices, getting your furnaces checked this time of year, things like that, because of its carbon monoxide risks. And I wonder, do you find yourselves doing some community education as part of your USAR process, where you come in and you say, okay, folks, these are the things that we need to be aware of, so we don't have more, so you don't end up with more patients than you already have?
Yeah, I think we do. A lot of that is the USAR teams in many cases end up as a conduit for distribution of educational materials out to the public, or as a referral source for victims that are inquiring about those concerns. And so part of the USAR team's job is to be aware of what the local resources are. Are there flyers being produced by the local EMA? Where can they go to get additional information, et cetera, so that we're not necessarily the source of the information as much as we are the deliverer or the referrer to the information.
Joe, I have to ask you a presentation question, because I'm envisioning being in a DMAT tent, not really knowing a lot about what happens to somebody before they get to us. So we may not know a history of this guy was in a house with a camp stove in his living room. So we're looking at very flu-like symptoms. And one thing that always sticks out in the pre-hospital training books is you get this cherry red color. And as I've gained time as a paramedic, I learned that isn't always the case, and it doesn't typically occur until the patient's pretty much a goner. Could you reflect on that?
Well, I think you said it very clearly, Sam. My experience with it has also been that the vast majority of patients who are symptomatic have pretty vague and nondescript symptoms, from fatigue and headache and shortness of breath and confusion and other things like that. The cherry red color, I've only seen once in a patient who had carbon monoxide levels that were, you know, beyond 35, which is, you know, basically in the near death phase. As a matter of fact, this guy, we managed to intubate and get to a hyperbaric chamber. And he was treated for quite a while and had some neurological sequela afterwards from his exposure. But even that guy wasn't sort of the bright red coloration that I think all of us expect to see in one of those cases. So I would certainly caution folks that if that's what you think carbon monoxide poisoning looks like, you're going to miss about 90% of them.
That's the point I was wanting to make. What would cause that, Joe? I'm just curious.
The bright red coloration.
The coloring, yeah.
Yeah, so I think it's the hemoglobin being completely saturated with carbon monoxide, and that makes the hemoglobin go into its oxidized state, which is kind of what gives you the bright red color of blood. You know, as opposed to venous blood, which is deoxygenated blood. And so it's all of that hemoglobin appearing very close to the surface of the skin and giving you that kind of much redder color than you might expect to see in someone who was extracting oxygen from their hemoglobin, and therefore some of the veins in the under the skin were deoxygenated hemoglobin and therefore darker in color.
So suffice it to say, even though CO2 detectors are required by law in most places, making sure that, you know, you have good batteries in them, so even when the power is out, those will still react when they're needed to.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's the best prevention we have, but of course not everybody adheres to that. So there you go.
This is all part of the training regimen that goes into being prepared as a responder. It's a challenge to keep everything in your brain. And it's it's one of the reasons I enjoy doing my podcasts, including this one, is because it's a refresher for me. And I always tell people, you know, I always joke, you know, people should keep a copy of their protocols on the back of their, you know, toilet so that they can, you know, do the reading when they're in the mood to read, and always flip to the pages that have to do with the season they're in. So, you know, if it's summertime, you should be looking at near drownings and how you manage those patients and what your protocols say about how to treat those patients and hyperthermia patients and all these things. In the wintertime, you should be looking at hypothermia and carbon monoxide poisoning and whatever else the case may be. If you live near a ski resort, you should be looking at how you're managing fractures and things like that. So it seems like it's just a training issue, but it's one of those things, again, you don't see it that often to be able to be prepared when the time comes where you might run into a whole rash of these patients. And not to use the pun of a rash, but... Anyway, Joe, is this something that you guys work into your training when you talk about specific types of disasters? Do you get into the nitty gritty at Paragon of specific things they're going to see, or have you ever worked a CO patient into a scenario?
He will
well,
now.
I think, you know, you're exactly on target, and for us, it's mostly about the challenges of the tremendously wide differential diagnosis for a patient who has fairly vague and neurological symptoms or other complaints. And in the disaster setting, because the timelines are quite long and the patient may have been there for 3 or 4 days, you know, those patients look very different in their presentations of illnesses that we're used to seeing in a fairly acute setting. And so, you know, having folks think through everything from head injury to hypoglycemia to hypothermia to carbon monoxide to, you know, other noxious gases, you know, all of that stuff is part of what you have to be teaching people to do in order to maximize your ability to take care of those patients in a setting that's very challenging and with a group of patients who are presenting in a very atypical way that we as providers are not used to seeing on a regular basis.
So when folks, you know, reach out to you, how does Paragon tailor training to a specific organization's needs? Do you have an interview process you go through to see what they specifically want? Because I would imagine, you know, were I to call you for my region, I might not necessarily know what your capabilities are.
Well, it's a real challenge. You know, it is a very tailored product, and we do spend an awful lot of time having conversations with the folks that are interested in bringing us in. And I think half of that conversation is about all the different possibilities that we can do. In many cases, it's a lot more than they ever even imagined on their own. So we try to open up their minds a little bit and just sort of say, if you can think of it, we can probably find a way to do it. And then it's also talking through specifically who's going to be there, what are you trying to accomplish, what issues are you having in your local area, so that we can try to focus the training to really focus on those areas and or provide them a way to cross a bridge, as it were, to get their own local training kind of kickstarted and up and running.
Well, I know that you guys do a lot to bring those resources in, and you put a lot of effort into it. And we've interviewed people, Sam and I both. Sam, you can probably jump in and answer some of this, but you've talked to people that have come out of the training sessions that Paragon puts on, and they're just raving, you know, about how wonderful it was and how different it was and how much they learned and how they can't wait for the next one. And I think that this just speaks to why it's important to find a good resource, and when you find one, to continue to utilize it. And so Paragon is a great resource for folks out there. Joe, if folks want to reach out to you and maybe start that conversation and start that process of finding out what they can do, where can they find you?
Well, look for us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com. Also be looking, hopefully in the next couple of months, for a big update to our website. And we hope to be able to give folks a much better idea of what we do, and a much better description, a lot more visual and video stuff on there. So we're very excited about the website upgrades. You can find us through Facebook under Paragon Medical Group as well. And our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU. And if you're listening to the podcast, you can always reach out to us through disasterpodcast.com.
Yeah, and I would urge you to leave a comment. Maybe you'd like this clinical scenario and you'd like us to cover a different clinical topic. Well, leave a comment. That's all you got to do on this episode or any of the episodes, and say, hey, I want to hear about X or Y or Z. We'll cover them all, heck. And So please, you know, go over to disasterpodcast.com, leave a comment, and let us know what you want Joe and the rest of us to cover in future episodes clinically, and we'll make sure we make an effort to put those scenarios out there for you. We've got some other things planned in the near future, and we look forward to covering them with you as well, but we want to cover what you want to hear about, so definitely reach out to us for that. Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, I'll tell you in a second, but I have to throw out also, I agree with what you're saying, and I have interviewed those people, especially when we first met Jim and Joe, and they were doing the cadaver labs, which was something very different and something that paramedics in particular don't get access to very often. But this is not a one-trick pony. I mean, Paragon is so flexible, and everything from active shooter drills to cadaver labs and CPR research. I mean, there's nothing that they won't jump into if it has value to someone. So I just wanted to throw that out. But you can find me at Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 on most social media sites and on the disasterpodcast.com. And like Jamie said, I do hope you come by and visit us. And just one other point about carbon monoxide poisoning I have to make. I found this on Wikipedia. If you think you're in a haunted house, check your CO2 detector, because sometimes people with CO2 poisoning think they're seeing ghosts. Just thought I'd throw that out.
Wow,
and Jamie, where do we find you? Not in a haunted house.
Not in a haunted house. That's not my cup of tea. I will tell you that. I don't do horror movies. I don't do haunted houses.
But I've read your books.
I write about them, but I don't do them. Anyway, you can find me under the handle Podmedic just about anywhere. If you want to find my books, you can find me over at jamiedavisbooks.com. And of course, here at the Disaster Podcast, disasterpodcast.com, where we try to cover a variety and broad group of topics having to do with emergency response, disaster response, and clinical topics for responders. So we want to hear back from you. Head over to disasterpodcast.com, check out all our episodes, subscribe to the podcast over there, and also reach out and get back in touch with us by leaving a comment. You know, Sam, this has been a great topic. I know we're going to cover some more clinical topics here coming up in the near future, and I'm looking forward to that. So people, come back for more. There's going to be more, and we'll talk about a lot to do with disaster medicine.
We will, and tonight is just another reflection of the fact that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.